This is James Corbett, and you're tuned into CorbettReport.com on the 20th of April, 2010. For those keeping track at home, it's that time of the month where we're talking to our favorite regular guest, Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster. Bob Chapman, it's great to have you back on the program again tonight.
Well, thank you very much. It's certainly a joy to be back.
Excellent. Well, Mr. Chapman, today I wanted to talk specifically about the crisis that we see unfolding in Europe, and I'm not sure exactly how to define that crisis, but there certainly seems to be a number of forces at play that seem to be threatening the European project. And I note that in the latest edition of the International Forecaster, you even note that George Soros is talking about how the European project is stalled and it may be going backwards. So definitely some titanic forces at play right at the moment. And we see things like, of course, the situation in Greece and many other things that are unfolding right now. But before we get into some of the specifics about what's happening, maybe we can set the scene a little bit and talk a little bit about your experience with Europe, because I know that you've lived there before. So tell us a little bit about your time in Europe and your take on the European culture in general.
Well, the culture certainly changes from state to state. State in the sense that it's a region, or like in Germany, a Kreis, which is a state. And the differences in people and the way they act in different areas is enormous. I mean, people don't realize that Europe is a conglomeration of tribes, and it still is. And you go to Munich and they speak Bayerisch, and you go over to Stuttgart and they speak Schwabisch, and you go into North and Central Germany and they speak Plattdeutsch. And so there is distinct differences still after thousands of years. And I lived in Germany for several years, and in France, Copenhagen, London, in Barcelona, Zurich, Geneva. I went to school in Geneva for French at the Interpreter's School at the Université de Genève. So I got to see an awful lot of things over the years that I lived there, which were basically contiguous. My first introduction was when I was working in Army counterintelligence, and my job, like a handful of others, was to spy on the Soviet Union and its satellites. And so the educational process was not only local and domestic, but it was far-ranging, because we used to intercept the communications of the Russians and others behind the Iron Curtain. And, of course, they did the same with us, probably with relatively the same success, maybe not as good, but they were very good adversaries, so to speak. They knew what they were doing, and so you got a lot of perspectives about the involvement of people in Western Europe in spying. They think nothing of it as long as it pays well, and that might be surprising to Americans, but it isn't to Europeans. In fact, after East and West Germany came together, it was found that there were many, many, many people in Western Germany at that time when the amalgamation finally came back together again that were working for the Stasi and the Russian counterintelligence operations from the lowest level. But anyway, that's a prelude to the fact that the European Union, 27 countries, was a natural conglomeration of groups. And when you have that kind of diversity, you can never really put them together as a unit, whether it's constitutionally or financially. It just doesn't work. I mean, they can't even get along with each other in their own countries. And that's pretty obvious sometimes. And so with that said, they formed a little over 10 years ago the European Eurozone, of which originally there were 14 members, now there's 16. And Greece and Italy were two of them, and they should have never been admitted. And in that process, the Germans and the French, particularly, and the Dutch, who were the powers within the Eurozone, particularly German, they looked the other way. They knew what was going on. They knew Goldman Sachs were making a bogus books for both countries, and they knew that in time there probably would be problems, but they wanted the unit, and they also wanted the ability to be able to export to these other countries within the Union because there weren't any tariffs. And that's how the problem came about. So there was some blame to be laid on the other more powerful members of the Eurozone, as well as the profligate Greeks and Italians, and eventually even the Spanish, the Portuguese, and Ireland, all of which are in trouble. They call them the pigs, P-I-I-G-S. And so you had a situation which was bad from the very beginning. Now, the big question is, why did they decide, they, the people who make the decisions behind the scenes, why did they decide to bring Greece to the attention of the world at this particular time, a few months ago? And I think the reason why is, I think they realize that the European Union and the Eurozone are a broken effort. It's not working. And I don't believe it could have ever worked in the first place. But because these people are bent toward world government, they had to try it. And they've tried it innumerable times before, being equally unsuccessful. And history is replete with their mistakes, incidentally. And so I think that they are ready to make some dramatic changes behind the scenes. And I think the comments of George Soros bear this out. They had the color revolutions in Ukraine, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and these other places, all of which were successful at the beginning. And over the last 4 to 5 years, they've all come apart. And probably one of the worst examples is Ukraine. And, you know, the people are just wandering around, what do we do next? And so I think what's happening here is that the people behind the scenes, their involvement still is for world government. This is what they're after. And I think they're changing gears here. And the reason they are is they're going to slowly and subtly and secretly take down these countries. But I think they're going to do it simultaneously. And I think they're lining them up. There's 19 countries that are close to or into bankruptcy. And that includes the United Kingdom as well as the U.S., the United States. And so I believe that somewhere along the line over the next year or two, maybe a little bit longer, that there is going to be a default on a multilateral basis of debts between countries, sovereign governments, and a general overall devaluation of currencies, all to some extent. How it will work will remain to be seen. And I think they'll introduce as the new international trading unit, a G7 unit, which will be based upon a weighted index, which will change all the time, and which will be available all the time for world trade, or at least trade with those who trade with Europe. And so that's the direction I think they're taking this, and I think it's being done deliberately, and I think they realize that the only way they can implement world government is from the top down. And in so doing that, they have to bring the world economically and financially to its knees in order to get the world to accept this world government, which will be accompanied by another major war.
All right. Wow. Well, an incredible overview there. So let's use that as the framework for our discussion tonight, because you touched on a number of the points that I want to flesh out in a little bit more detail, including the fact that you started with your sort of redefinition of my initial question. And I think you're quite right, because we throw terms like European culture around with great ease and felicity, but I think that shows maybe the effect of decades of brainwashing from the centralized globalist government, rather than the actual people on the ground who don't feel that there is a European project that they're a part of or that they want to be a part of. Can you speak to the discrepancy between what's happening on the sort of the macroeconomic and the regional scale, as opposed to what people are experiencing in their day-to-day lives in Europe?
Well, there's always been regions that have been very productive in many ways, and other regions that have not. I mean, you look at Italy as a good example. The people in the north are called by the people in the south the Italian Jews, and they don't mean it in any religious or sectarian sense. It's in a business sense, whereas the southern part of Italy is very, very different in culture and attitude than northern Italy. And northern Italy has always been successful and prosperous, and so they think they're all sharp businessmen, and that points out the term that they use, American. Unless I told them that, would never know that term. I know it because I live there, and part of my family is Italian, and so there's great differences. In fact, very often politicians will say, "Well, why don't we just cut everything off south of Rome and let's have two countries because we're so different." California is the same way. The people in Northern California are very, very different from Southern California. I lived there 36 years. I know, and so you have these macro situations, as you mentioned. In southern Italy, it's generally been farming as opposed to industry. And farming is very often cyclical, and it's at the mercy of weather and other things. And, like rigging markets, and not in Italy, but internationally. And whereas in northern Italy, it's been a far more diverse culture. And that sort of thing happens everywhere. Every country has its ups and downs and its pet peeves and its prejudices. I mean, I never forget in Paris, I asked for some direction to some place one day in French. And the guy says to me, "Je ne comprends pas. Tu ne parles pas les Français," which means, "You don't understand. I can't understand you." He says, "You're not speaking French." And, you know, they're insulting. And if I came from Lyon or Marseille and asked the same question, they'd give me the same rude answer. And so, you know, that's the cultural differences that foreigners can never understand.
Absolutely. And I think that's important to be keeping in mind specifically in this context, because when we're talking about the European Union, what we're really seeing is this process of indoctrination that's been going on a top-down level for so many years to try to, I guess, instill some sort of European identity or culture or some sort of feeling for the European people, for the European Union. But it just seems so obvious that there's just widespread and mass unpopularity of the European Union, and there always has been ever since the entire project was really first rolled out. And I think that's really not abating. In fact, it's only seems to be increasing. And we've seen this time and again. Whenever there's been any sort of democratic referendum allowed on the European Union, the voters have chosen to overwhelmingly reject it. And we saw that with the Lisbon Treaty that had to be rammed through Ireland by getting the Irish to vote on it until they got it right. So can you speak to some of the widespread unpopularity of the European Union among the European people?
Well, in Germany, it certainly was never popular. I think the approval rate at the time that it came into being was about 54%. And as time wore on over the first couple of years, particularly when they changed currencies, inflation jumped about 25% because everybody raised prices. And it wasn't only in Germany, it was all over Europe. So it was an expensive proposition. And as time wore on, people, and I'll use Germany as an example because it's a powerhouse, as it wore on, what happened was that people became more and more disenchanted. And today, 69% of men and 71% of women in Germany do not want the European Union, nor do they want the euro. They want their Deutschmark back. And one of the reasons is that they work very hard. They save. They're not profligate spenders. And many of the other countries are. And they resent that because they have a very positive balance of payments surplus. And within that Eurozone, that is used in behalf of all the other countries who have deficits. And so they're just sick and tired of carrying everybody. And on the other hand, just recently, you've probably seen the rest of Europe saying, well, the Germans are cheating, they're not spending. And go out and do what we do so you can wreck your economy too.
Right, exactly. Well, there does seem to be that particular tension at the moment, and Germany seems to be having the greatest problems with what's happening in Greece. And you mentioned in the latest forecaster that a German economist is to make a legal challenge against the aid package for Greece. And we've seen a lot of tension between Berlin and Brussels going on lately, which is a very interesting dynamic, since obviously Germany is really one of the... Is probably the central economic powerhouse in the European monetary zone at the moment, but I guess expanding on that in a more general sense, we certainly do see the tensions between the haves and the have-nots in Europe, but we also see I think just widespread antipathy for the entire European Union government and the way the government has been set up to be so anti-democratic. I don't think it has many friends in the European people themselves. So I guess expanding on that from the perspective of what's happening economically at the moment, you were talking earlier about the our old friends Goldman Sachs having helped cook the books for Greece and Italy to massage things so that they could enter the European monetary zone several years ago. Can you speak more specifically about what was done in those cases and how it was recently discovered?
Well, what they did was include, quote, future taxation and income on today's balance sheets 10 years ago. And so what they said was that, well, we're going to get, the projection is an 8% increase in tax revenues and in income from imposts and duties. And so that will qualify us. And in the case of Greece, it's now become very well known that the Greece used derivatives, particularly recently in the last few years, and they were never able to keep their books straight, and their books must really be a mess, because today we have governments and particularly companies, particularly in the financial area, that are using two sets of books and nobody cares. I mean, it's just total fraud.
It certainly is, and I don't think that's really surprising to anyone who, as you say, has been following the European monetary zone and the way it was set up. I think everyone kind of expected something like this to happen. And as you said, that it seems to be coming out now, and it seems to be coming out for a reason. So let's talk a little bit more about how and why it's being exposed right now.
Well, I think in the final analysis, as I said at the very beginning, I think the experience that they've had, they know it cannot continue to go on, and in the form that they formed it, which was first the European Economic Union and then the European Union. You know, this started right after the Second World War, and was very popular in projection during the 1950s and 60s. and I forget the fellow's name who really pushed it. And I used to read it all about it all the time when I was in Europe, but I can't remember. But the point here is that in order to understand financially and economically, politically, in the world today, and particularly in Europe and the United States, what is going on is that there are powerful people who are behind all governments, who have a great deal of money, who buy politicians. And why they want to do that is, of course, to accumulate more money and power, but more importantly, they all want world government, and they all work together. And some of the groups of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberger Group, the Black Nobility of Europe, and the Group of 30, the Group of 300, and it goes on and on. There's a whole bunch of them. And they're all interconnected. And this is their goal. They think they know better what is good for people than people know themselves. And so these guiding lights, these masters of the universe, they think that they're going to be able to institute world government. And they're going to go about that by destroying the system. And they've done it before. This is not the first time. And they think out of that chaos, they can create this world government. And they're mistaken, because today's communications is such that there's not much they can do that we don't know about within several hours, whereas it might take years previously, and that might be 40 or 50 years ago. But it's different today. In other words, we know what you're doing, and we know who's doing it, and we know where you're headed, and we're imparting that knowledge through reports like the Corbett Report, talk radio, and particularly on the internet. And it's going all over the world. And they had to expedite their projects for world government. And the reason why they had to was because of these facilities that are available to people like you and I to tell the people the truth about what's really going on. And it's a terrible situation. I ran into someone yesterday who's been a subscriber, a young man, and his father worked in clandestine operations for the United States government for years, both in counterintelligence as well as in the interdiction of narcotics and things like that. And the upshot of the whole thing was complete confusion after a life of working for the U.S. government, retiring and refusing the pension because it was blood money. And, you know, this is the kind of conclusion people like this gentleman who is now deceased and myself come to, because what's happened is you get into the fight and you try to do the right thing, and you find out there are no good guys and bad guys, they're all bad. And it's demoralizing. And you have to be very, very strong to be able to handle it. And so that's why people like he and I and you understand what's going on. So in order to understand economically and financially, politically and socially, where we're headed, you have to study history. You have to know what these people have been up to for generations. And if you know about it, you've got to talk about it. Because if you don't, nobody else is going to. I mean, there's very few newsletter writers or commentators or hosts who will talk about the things that we talk about. Because everybody's terrified. Or, and rightly so, people do get killed by these people. But they also want to be accepted among their peers. And obviously, I don't care. I just tell it the way it is and let it lie where it lies. And that's my mission.
And I think as people take up that message that's now being spread by more and more and more people, and those walls start to tumble down, we do see that titanic shift that we see happening in the information war, as you mentioned earlier, that we're now at the point where we're absolutely clobbering them in the info war and exposing all of their carefully laid plans even as they're being laid. So there's no doubt that we're having an incredible effect, but there's also no doubt that the same psychopathic globalists who have been in charge of society for generations are still have their hands on the levers of power and on the levers of wealth creation, and they can turn that spigot on and off as they see fit. And one example of that is what we see going on in Greece today, and just ahead of the EU IMF bailout plan for Greece, we see the Greeks already starting to adopt the measures of extreme austerity that I think is the ultimate end game for the entire worldwide economic meltdown. And we see that in a Reuters article from April 17th, Greeks cutting back as EU IMF help looms, according to a survey. And it's talking about a survey of people in Athens who are cutting back in their basic personal expenses in ahead of proposed austerity measures. So can you talk a little bit about the IMF decision to help out in this Greek aid package and what that means for Europe in general?
Well, the IMF was created by the U.S., and they're the main contributor. And what they are is an international SS. They go around to countries who have mishandled their finances, and they lend them money, and they institute an austerity program, which puts them in a position where they can really never recover. And that means that they're financially in bondage to the IMF. And that's what the IMF is all about, control. Control of countries, usually smaller countries. And as we know, it has been the mission of the United States, and maybe all of you don't know, that they have people that go in behalf of the United States secretly in trying to do things that put other governments at a tremendous disadvantage under the guise that they're helping them. And, of course, then when they get in serious trouble in marches, or I should say goose steps, the IMF tells people what to do. And so this is a method of control, and it's used all the time. It has been for years by the United States. I mean, you know, I grew up and I learned a whole different set of values about America than what I found when I went into counterintelligence. It was a totally different world. I learned the truth about what was going on, and it was really horrifying for a young man. I just couldn't believe that they were worse than the mafia.
And yet they are. And what, yeah, exactly. Well, what can we do to combat that other than to take back that power that they've wrested from the people? And I'd like to get specifically into the way that you see the current crisis playing out. Obviously, you've mentioned many times that you think there's going to be a multilateral devaluation of currencies take place. So let's think specifically step by step how this is likely to play out. Obviously... Sorry about that.
Okay. Well, I think what's going to happen as we had a little bleep there. I think what's going to happen is we're going to have inflation and hyperinflation. How bad it'll get, I really don't know. I don't think anybody else does, even the people who are perpetrating it. In order to keep the system afloat during this period of time over the next couple of years, I really do believe that there is a point at which they expect to make things change, pull a plug, so to speak, on inflation and hyperinflation, which would come to eventually a deflationary depression. And they need that in order to force people to do what they want them to do, and as a distraction, they'll have a war within the next 3 years, possibly within the next two, and maybe as quickly as one. We just don't know. And that's the way I see that financially and economically playing out, because I know the history and I know what they've done before and what I expect them to do again. And that's why they manipulate all markets now, and they control the sources of power almost totally financially and economically, and they play it like a Stradivarius. And we're fighting them all the time in the markets, trying to expose what they're doing, particularly in gold and silver, where the manipulation is so blatant. I mean, they just don't care anymore. It used to be like in the late 70s and then in the late 60s, excuse me, and into the 1970s when they illegally rigged markets. Then they had the executive order of August 1988 after the collapse in 87, which allowed them to be able to continue to legally rig the markets. And that was a very, very damaging blow for the world, and particularly the people who are investors in the United States, because they never realized this. I started to write about it that month in August of 88. People thought I was insane. And now it's finally being talked about in the mainline media, which really doesn't want to carry it, because the mainline media is controlled by the people from behind the scenes. They own 98% of their companies.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So what order do you see that playing out in? You see some sort of staged provocation to lead into a war-type footing, which will lead to the hyperinflation, which will lead to the deflationary depression?
Well, I think the inflation is already in the pipeline. And as is some kind of hyperinflation, what is hyperinflation? Is it over 10%? Is it over 20%? 2.5 years ago, we had 14%, but nobody, you know, paid any mind to it because the government said it was only 5.5%. The government says it's 2.5 to 3% right now, when it's 7.5 to 8%. And so I think there's a good chance this year that we'll see a climb up to real 14% and another 5.5%. That'll be admitted to by the United States government through bogus statistics. And I think after that, it's hard to call because they have been pulling money out of the system. But the problem is the money they pulled out to put back in, or the system's going to collapse. So they're sliding down the edge of a razor blade, if you may. And no matter which way they fall off the razor blade, it's not going to be good. And so they're trying to run this orchestra, and it's not as easy as that. And so I think they're going to end up into hyperinflation, and I think they secretly have their own idea of when they're going to go into a deflationary collapse. And I think it'll be a couple of years from now.
Well, very chilling, and we have to do what we can to get the word out about it before then and hopefully head them off at the pass. But speaking of wars and rumors of wars, what's your take on the Polish plane crash that took the life of the Polish president and decapitated the Polish armed forces?
Well, first of all, we don't have anything solid. And over time, information will come out. I recently saw something by a Polish representative of him, if you may, and he said it was the Russians. Maybe it was. I really don't think so. I think that the course that had been charted, government in particular, not so much the military, but the government, was that they had said that, look, we don't want the IMF loans. We're doing okay. And if the IMF wants to get some funding from us, we'll be happy to give it to them to the limits that we're able to do that. And the powers behind government were thunderstruck. You know, who are these people to tell us what they're going to do because we're supposed to be controlling them. And so there was also the matter of putting missiles into Poland, and that was ostensibly because Iran was going to shoot missiles from Iran and pass through that area, and of course Americans would shoot them down. When in fact, that wasn't the reason at all. It was to intimidate Russia. And so I think that they were having extreme misgivings about allowing the Americans to set up these missiles there. And some of them were only about 30 miles from Russia. It's obvious what the United States was up, which was aggression, which is normal, which we've been doing for years. And it has to stop, but it's not stopping because we don't have any control, because the guns are controlled from behind the scenes by people who want that to happen. That is, that America will have Russia geopolitically outflanked. And that's one of the reasons why we had conflict in Iraq as well as Afghanistan, particularly Afghanistan, because of their geopolitical position, not only on the flank of Russia, but also on the flank of India, Pakistan, and China as well. And besides growing lots of opium and making lots of money, our government has been setting itself up in a position where they can exert control within the periphery in that region.
That's right. Unfortunately, Mr. Chapman, you're starting to break up a little. Maybe we're revealing a little bit too much truth tonight. But in wrapping up the conversation then, so what do you see as any positive signs or any positive things that people can take away for Europe and anything that might be coming along that the European people can use as a point of leverage against the globalists?
Well, I think the rear Europeans have to face down the fact that they've made a mistake and that the forces that are running their governments are not their own representatives. And they've got to stop that, just like the Americans have to. And you've got to do that through the system. And the system just lets throw them out of office. And if we can do that in the United States and in Europe, we've got a chance of legally changing the system. If we can't do that, this situation continues to degenerate at the behest of these people behind the scenes, then you're going to see chaos throughout the world. You're going to have a third world war going, which may or may not be nuclear. And then on top of that, you're going to have revolutions within countries. There's going to be lots of them. I mean, everybody's fed up, and there's enough people in each country now that knows who's doing what to whom that they're going to act. And I get letters from all over the world say, we know what you're saying, and it's happening in our country, and we're going to follow these ideas of using the system, and if it doesn't work, we're going to overthrow our government. Come right away. So there's a lot of disgust among people of their own inaction over the years to allow this to continue to happen. And I think those kinds of things are coming to a head.
Do you think people are waking up to the fact that there is the governments themselves and the controlled politicians inside them are not the actual center of the power structure, and that we need to be looking at organizations like the European Central Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the Bank of International Settlements as places where the power centers really reside?
Well, there are certain people within each country who are catching on. It's not a large percentage, maybe 15, 20, 25%. But changes come about, unfortunately, through revolutions. And all you need is 5% who are dedicated to changing things, and things get changed. We saw that in the American Revolution. And so I think, unfortunately, if the powers behind government do not back off and do not stop doing what they're doing, and they go for the whole enchilada, so to speak, then what's going to happen is that the world's going to be in chaos. And there's no way to avoid it unless they stop doing what they're doing.
Absolutely right. Very sobering thoughts. And on that note, Bob Chapman, tell people about the International Forecaster.
Well, the forecast is about business, finance, economics, social and political issues all over the world. We publish on Wednesdays and Saturdays by email. Runs around 40 pages each time, and we have a hard copy for those who are not on the internet, and you can get a free introductory current copy by going to our site, theinternationalforecaster.com, forecaster.com. If you have a question, you can email us. That address is Bob, B-O-B, at I-N-T, forecaster.com. That's Bob at intforecaster.com. Or you can call 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. And all the things that you need to know every week are in that publication.
That's absolutely right. I certainly hope people will check it out and check out the website as well to stay up to date with what's going on in the world. And Bob Chapman, it is a pleasure, as always, to have you on the program. I look forward to our next conversation.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you all for listening. Bye-bye.